Today's podcast is brought to you by Paranoid Delusions. On those lonely days when you're the only one you know that has the world all figured out, try Paranoid Delusions.
Just like the Bible says, it's basically an intergalactic invasion into this space through people. I'm telling you, it's what all the ancients said, it's what they warned of, it's what we're dealing with. They're demons. They're freaking interdimensional invaders, okay? I'll just say it, make fun of me all you want on CNN or wherever, but everyone already innately knows this. These people are not freaking humans, okay? Hillary Clinton is a damn demon.
Hi, my name's Nate Staley, and welcome to Off Baseline. It's the fourth week of January 2018. Today on this show, I talked to a former colleague, Jody DeBoer, LMSW, about community mental health centers, what they are, how they function, who goes there, what kinds are there, and how are they funded. In the news these past couple of weeks, in a time of big buttons and tiny rocket men barreling their countries closer to unnecessary conflict, presumably the new guy at a civil defense mistakenly hits the apocalypse is here, this is not a drill, here come the nukes button. Damn it, Jerry. The government shuts down and starts back up. CHIP is reauthorized for 6 years. Many are accusing Chuck Schumer of caving in before a deal for DACA recipients who continue to be on the chopping block to be sent to countries they have not really known. But first, ramped up deportation enforcement has a high-profile case with Jorge Garcia, a man who brought into this country as a child, was deported on Martin Luther King Day. This from the Detroit Free Press. Jorge Garcia was brought to the U.S. by an undocumented family member when he was 10 years old. Today he has a wife and two children, all of whom are U.S. citizens. He's been trying for years to find a path to live legally in the U.S., with he and his wife spending $125,000 in legal costs and fees since 2005, says his wife. Garcia had been facing an order of removal from immigration courts since 2009, but under the previous administration, he had been given stays of removal. But because of the Trump administration's immigration crackdown, Garcia was ordered in November to return to Mexico. His supporters say he has no criminal record, not even a traffic ticket, and pays his taxes every year. And we've had kind of a nasty history of backlash immigration policies and enforcement in our past. The Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, the 1917 Act that mandated English-speaking literacy tests for immigrants, using a test requiring them to read five lines from the Constitution. Later, the Johnson-Reed Act in 1924 included policies like the National Origins Formula, which is restricting on the basis of representative population and national origin quotas to prevent ethnic shift. The Asian Exclusion Act, which is exactly what it sounds like, and other restrictions specifically on African, Arab, Italian, and Eastern European Jews. The officially stated rationale of those acts in the past was to preserve the ideal of American homogeneity. I can't even say the word right. And each of these acts were reactions to essentially the waves of immigration that were instrumental in establishing the culture and influence. I'm getting interrupted by Alex Jones here. I can't shut him up.
If the cops showed up and said, come out, you know, and they had the bullhorn, come out or we're going to fire tear gas, and you just go, ice cream cone.
Yeah.
All right, I'll just throw
Mr. Jones that way. So yeah, what I was basically getting at was these acts, these different immigration acts, were influential. They were reactions to waves of immigration that were influential or instrumental in developing and establishing culture and influence in America, in raising the population and making it this sort of thing that it's been celebrated for over the years, of being this giant dream, this place where you can make it. It really wasn't established that way by just having a handful of special white Puritans that tamed, the savages. There's been a kind of a storied sort of sense of I made it here because of immigration, but you've got to go kind of mentality. The irony of Marco Rubio adopting the modern GOP platform kind of comes to mind when I think about this. Little Marco. My parents brought me over here on a boat from Cuba, and let's be honest, Fidel was not sending his best. Here's why we need to make sure I never happen again. I kind of went from a Trump impression to a Marco Rubio impression there. It was a very interesting transformation from boy to man, or reverse. Trauma, basically, when I think about the children of Jorge, kind of what his family's sort of going through as this man who's kind of an institution kind of in his community, a strong family man, model citizen. I definitely have, if he has no traffic tickets, I considerably have more traffic tickets than he does. But I just think about the traumatizing effect it has to sort of rip your father away from the family for a reason that doesn't make any sense. For some twisted reason, it makes sense to adults, but it doesn't make sense to children because he didn't do anything. There's nothing to point to say, oh, you did that, you made that choice. It's a decision his parents made that he had nothing to do with. And so now their family has to be torn apart. To just not understand what's happening or why, it's really disgusting. It's really hard to have family values without families, is a thought I'm having there. To claim that the nuclear family is the solution for moral society. I'm sure you've heard the Bill O'Reilly trope, the problem with all those African Americans is their pants are too low. They listen to satanic hip hop and their fathers aren't there. Where are all the fathers? That's the problem. There are no fathers, no family values. Well, so now deporting hardworking, loving dads is kind of the new sort of policy of that same, from that same source. And, I kind of wish they were deporting Bill O'Reilly instead, to be honest. I don't know. Maybe I'm alone in that. But people are saying, many, many people are saying that. Send Bill O'Reilly. I think I remember in my unironically saying that he would migrate to Ireland if America passed universal health care, which Ireland has. We'll see. There's this excuse also kind of along those lines that's made in the argument that we're supposedly a country of laws, that we seem to, in rhetoric at least, worship laws as an end all. When someone says it's the law, sorry, there's supposed to be some kind of inherent moral imperative, and they're not really sorry. But why do laws exist in the first place? What are they supposed to do? What's their role in society? Since this is a social science podcast, I'd like to look at how maybe a classic sociologist like Max Weber looked at the function of laws in a broader societal system. So I'll just read a kind of a quote. As a sort of a theoretical background, rational adjudication on the basis of rigorously formal legal concepts is to be contrasted with a type of adjudication which is guided primarily by sacred traditions without finding therein a clear basis for the decision of concrete cases. So that's Weber stating that in very, very wonderfully convoluted verbiage that there are different forms of justice or legal decisions that are changed by, brought on by institutional norms, by traditions, by social norms. So many systems are kind of based on sort of irrationality of development based on precedent and administered by, you know, a field of lawyers and jurists, you know, and so, you know, laws are kind of a representation of the history of the society, of the people that were in charge of developing these, and they're in response to, you know, the last person that made a law. They're in response to sort of what's going on at the time in society. They're not, you know, they're not handed down to Moses on, you know, two stone tablets with, you know, sort of these are now and forever the divinely inspired laws that are inherently good and should never be changed, and all of these are good. You know, he kind of makes the case that or kind of describes the existence of laws as something that's inherently contextual, and something that is kind of built on by tradition and by flawed human thinking and just sort of flawed, very changing, sort of fluctuating societies. So, and then we have Emile Durkheim, who basically emphasized that, you know, the influence of history in changing the nature of the law and its application. So, kind of going a little bit on what was said before. So, there's society values that are brought on by sort of, you know, kind of the majority with, the, you know, that kind of reflect individual rights and responsibilities. But there's also a lot of variation in that. It's not very predictable. It's very infrequent. And so it's going to be changing constantly. And we see that. And, you know, this all seems pretty basic when you kind of look at it that way, but it's not basic, though, or at least it's not acted on like it's basic. It's something that we kind of in our discourse, in our dialogues, you know, we hear that shouted out. It's the law. Well, laws are largely meant to be looked at, reviewed, and constantly edified as society, you know, grows, learns, makes mistakes, sort of develops itself. And there's such a thing as a bad law. And I think the way that we have treated immigrants in the past, despite being a country that came into existence based on immigrants, came into existence under ideals, whether followed or not, of sort of equality of classes of people, you know, at the same time, we might have laws or enforcement of laws that are very flawed. And I think we need to look at our value systems and question why they're there and whether they reflect, you know, what they, you know, what our moral aspirations are. Do we desire to treat people equally? Do we desire everyone to have the same skin color? Do we desire to have diversity? You know, these are questions that you need to at least be honest and upfront with, regardless of the side that you're on. So just a little kind of exercise and some honesty there as we try to think at sort of an elevated level as to how do we respond to some very very troubling, very very sort of disturbing images we see of, you know, families getting torn apart, of creating sort of like baby and kids rooms for these deportation facilities and these hearings. You know, it's a great time for introspection into your own personal views of what makes a society just and moral, and you know, what laws should be reconsidered and thought about, and you know, why do you arrive at the immigration inclinations that you do? You guys, things with North Korea have gotten pretty bad recently. It's long been rumored that by developing weapons, they've made breakthroughs in recent years. They seem to be testing how far they can fling their ballistic missiles. They've stated a desire to destroy America. And on the other side, I'm sure you've read our president's tweet, which in the way our executive branch functions now is basically based off of tweets. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un just stated that the nuclear button is on his desk at all times. Will someone from his depleted, food-starved regime please inform him that I, too, have a nuclear button, but this one is much bigger and a more powerful one than his, and my button works. Apparently, over at the Civil Defense Office in Hawaii, there's an even bigger button that you can press to tell everyone that the world is ending and that you're going to die. So, and that was pressed on accident, and everyone received a message on their phone basically telling them that the world is over. And I think I have a little bit of a clip of what that might have sounded like. So it went over to everyone's phones. It also broadcast over the radio, and it sort of had this little bar over the TV screen when they were watching basketball on Saturday, college basketball. But so this is kind of some audio of the message that they were hearing.
Into Hawaii. A missile may impact on land or sea within minutes. This is not a drill. If you are indoors, stay indoors. If you are outdoors, seek immediate shelter in a building. Remain indoors well away from windows. If you are driving, pull safely to the side of the road and seek shelter in a building or lay on the floor. We will announce when the threat has ended. This is not a drill. Take immediate action measures. Repeat. The U.S. Pacific Command has detected a missile threat to Hawaii. A missile may impact on land or sea within minutes. This is not a drill. If you are indoors, stay indoors.
So that's basically what they were hearing at the time. And it took upwards of, so they sent the message out. It said, warning, ballistic missile threat, seek immediate shelter. This is not a drill. It was kind of what you were hearing there. And it said it on people's phones too. It took like about 30 or 40 minutes for the civil defense to send a follow-up message, basically saying that everything was okay, that in fact nuclear war wasn't happening, but you know, we had a shift change, and in the shift change, I guess they clicked the wrong button. Kind of makes me think of, I was reading a book recently, or actually, let's be honest, I was listening to a book, an audio book called Raven Rock, the U.S. government's plan to save itself while the rest of us die, which is, it's a pretty intense title of a book. And it's basically, it kind of details its sort of how it developed over time. The chain of command, it developed underground bunkers, and it developed all these different things that these different plans in the event that they basically had to just pick a handful of people and survive, and, you know, freestanding underground cities and bunkers, and they shrink wrapped a bunch of $2 bills when they created a whole bunch of them in the 70s, and people decided that they didn't like using $2 bills, so they figured in the event of a nuclear war, you wouldn't have much of a choice as to what bill you wanted to use. And so, fun fact, there would be, and probably would still be, plenty of $2 bills to go around if that were to could develop in that environment. But, you know, it raises an interesting sort of question for me. I woke up, and when my son wakes up, he usually wakes me up on Saturday, and that's the day that I can stay home from work and sort of let my wife sleep and watch him and have some time with my son. And I got the kind of the messages that people were freaking out initially about a nuclear ballistic missile threat. And there was a moment where there was no way to even searching through Twitter or anything like that to confirm that it was a false alarm. And so, you know, you can't imagine sort of what they were going through at the time, just even thinking about what you do. I mean, we haven't as a country thought about that. And well, since I've been alive, really, I was born kind of, late 80s at the end of the Cold War. And so you didn't really have that kind of growing up in the 90s and the early 2000s. You had 9/11, but that was sort of, the scope was a little bit different. But you just think about sort of, you know, when you're faced with moments where you are looking at life from a sense of mortality, a sense of limitness, a sense of limitations on what you can accomplish and how much time you have and who you're going to spend time with and what you're going to spend your life doing, it can, you know, from sort of an existential, philosophical, and even existential counseling theories model, that can provide a moment of clarity of your values, of why you want to live, of, you know, your acknowledgement that your life kind of breathing breath in the body that you're in is very finite. And despite the routines that you get yourself in to throughout the day and throughout kind of existing in a sort of labor for pay contract and a day-to-day capitalist society, you sort of lose sight of the limitations of time, of what you kind of set out, what you idealize as goals, and years go by when you're not living intentionally. And, you know, not to say that, you know, the even idea or the existence of nuclear weapons is a moral, is morally appalling. And it's something that I think we need to work really hard to suppress and to rid ourselves of, because ultimately there's no good that can come out of that you know, mutually using it as sort of a deterrent is, you know, the best thing potentially that it can come out of it. And there are, you know, there comes a point when we have to sort of make that jump. And we've lived in an era of being in the Iraq war and the Afghanistan war for, you know, how long has it been now? Like 14 years, 15, 16 years in Iraq, maybe longer, 17 years. It was right after 9/11, but we've been in wars kind of here and there, sort of colonial, just sort of dipping our toes in the water in this region of the world and sort of keeping things the way we like it in other parts of the world. And really what stands out about North Korea is the fact that, you know, this carries actual potential threat and danger. And we get to a point when the weapons advance enough that, you know, it's kind of a tired phrase, but war becomes obsolete. And, you know, we have to ask if we're going to create a society worth having, a society that can actually empathize with each other, trust each other, and move beyond sort of war as the best tool we have to sort of iron out differences. Or an inevitable tool to iron out differences, if you know, that's going to be contingent on our survival. That's going to be necessary to survive. And it's an interesting time when you're to think about that. So we're going to go ahead and take a little bit of a break, but and sort of a musical interlude by the UK's a friend of mine, Noah, is in that band. And but first, maybe a little bit of a palate cleanser in the wake of such life-altering events in the shadows of all kinds of potential conspiracies. You know, maybe they just did that alert so we could be ready, you know, so they could test how ready we were. And maybe they are just trying to control our minds and change our, you know, how we use social media and change our preparedness for war, which, you know, that last point might actually be pretty valid, but perhaps we all need to be a little more sort of ready for the conspiracy, a little more alpha. Ladies and gentlemen, a word from today's sponsor, Paranoia.
Plan is to sell you on destroying yourself and your family and loving death and turning off your survival mechanism and destroying your family so the state and the computer robot age can corner every last one of you and slowly suck the life force out of you into the black of deep space.
So now that your palate has been cleansed, we'll take a brief musical interlude and we'll be back with today's guest, Jody DeBoer.
I got to know, have you seen Aunt Hazel? Last time I saw her, she was working tables at the corner bar, right across from the old church. She's so sweet, like lemonade on her front.
Joining me on the show today is Jody DeBoer. She's an LMSW. Did I get that lettering right? LMSW?
Yes, you got that right.
Yes. Sorry. I should know better, but I come from professional counseling, so there's we have our own sets of letters that are meaningless too. So we work together at a community mental health center in Missouri. So this is the first time talking to you in a while. How you been?
I've been doing all right. And yourself?
Well, I've been doing all right. Just raising my now 1 year old.
Right.
But I enjoyed our times leading teams of caseworkers together. That was pretty enjoyable.
It was a lot of fun.
So no real structure. Just kind of wanted to maybe talk to you a little bit about mental health agencies in general. One of the goals I think of the show is to just kind of provide a little bit more information. Just I think there's a lot of there's a void of information about mental health agencies, maybe even what they do, what they are, how they function, who they serve, how they're funded, all that kind of stuff. And so that's, pretty much what my goal is to maybe shed some light in about that. And I figured, what better way to do that than to just kind of bring on people that I've worked with or talked with in the past and go that route. So when we talk about, I guess I'll just start with this. When we talk about working at a mental health agency, what's kind of meant by that? Like, what's kind of the day to day of working at a community health mental health agency that maybe people just kind of assume, like, you send someone off to, or they might have conceptions about it that are kind of maybe extreme.
Right. Right. And I think one of the biggest misconceptions is they're all the same. They all do the same thing. That's a huge misconception. They all don't serve the same purpose, and they all don't offer the same exact things.
Right.
They might have the same general concepts behind them and evidence-based practices that they generally use, but they don't use the same ones. It kind of depends on what the function is of that particular agency.
Right. There's a lot of variation, and then within each agency there might even be more variation. Like at the agency that we both worked at, we were kind of in the adult. It was kind of focused on adult mental health, whereas there were different sub departments where it was, focused on children. There's a substance abuse treatment facility that was kind of affiliated with the agency.
Co-occurring disorders.
Co-occurring,
department,
yeah. Dual diagnosis, which actually is the facility that I wound up working at now. A dual diagnosis, so that's working with people with mental health disorders and with substance use or disorders. So people who are maybe have schizophrenia, but also have a meth. Use meth regularly, and that kind of complicates their what they're dealing with and what they're facing, or opiates or things like that. So you get different categories of facilities.
Oh, absolutely.
That's a good point to make. And
like at the hospital, I'm sure even. And they have different subunits. So then you have more of the acute care kind of side of things when people are really intensely having symptoms. And then you start stepping them down where they're still engaged with the community. They're coming in to see you, but they're still engaged in, or they're living in their home and doing, everyday things.
Right.
And then there's the next step down to where they don't need as intensive involvement within an agency.
Right. It can range quite a bit from just, kind of the outpatient private practice kind of looking office setting of a therapist to kind of an in-home care. Maybe if someone can't make it out, if they have a disability that prevents them from getting out, or if they're elderly and are physically unable to get out. Or just exactly. Kind of busy, like, kind of, a mother, single mother of three kids, and you know, it's kind of chaotic to even just get out of the house, and it's a lot easier if the clinician or the
to have that support in the home if they can,
right. If they can get the care worker to come there. So there's, you know, all types of different ranges, and there's inpatient versus outpatient. You know, are they staying there, or are they just coming in once or twice or three times a week, or
or all the way down to like once a month. It really depends on the need,
right,
you know,
right,
where the person's at in their healing process.
Yeah. So, and then, you know, kind of in the department that we worked in, and we were supervising caseworkers, and I use the past tense because of me not being there, but you are currently in that environment.
Right.
You know, kind of working with caseworkers. So caseworkers that kind of drive out to their homes, or do various tasks as far as connecting them with resources. Maybe they need to find, you know, food or have access to food, so they take them to a food bank, or you know, need help filling out documentation for some kinds of social services. If they need to get food stamps or apply for Medicaid, or if they're disabled and can't work, then for disability, you know, kind of a wide range of things. So that's the caseworker side of things. And oftentimes there, you know, in our department, there were nurses that kind of were a part of assessments that we do just to kind of check general health, you know, not kind of the same thing as replacing other interactions with the healthcare. But we kind of take a lot of facilities anyway, take a kind of a holistic approach to mental health being affected by, you know, the whole person, you know, the physical, the emotional, the, you know, kind of all
spiritual,
different kinds of factors,
yeah.
The spiritual, right?
Right. Yeah. And their physical health, they all play a role into people's well-being in general. So, yeah. And you know, that's one of the things that I've found, with Missouri itself, they have that added component of the nurses being a real strong part of the community mental health, at least in the community that we've worked in. And it's my understanding that something that happened statewide here in Missouri. Other states I've lived in do not currently have that at this time, where they do a metabolic for their mental health community. So, you know, that is that holistic approach. Although we talk about it in mental health, it's not always being followed through with on some of those pieces, in the whole way that we experience it here.
Right.
So just thought you might want to note that.
No, it is. It's pretty unique in Missouri, the emphasis on some of the ways we go about it, like the involvement of the nurses. So it's, you know, and so there's also some interesting misconceptions sometimes when it comes to sometimes in a therapy appointment, I'll be seeing them for the first time, and they'll be kind of asking me, okay, when do I get my meds? You know, when are you going to, or the other day I had someone ask me, okay, when are you going to give me my injection of Haldol? You know, and it's like,
let me just
open up my drawer. You know, I'm a provisionally licensed, professional counselor, but let me pull out my med degree and my secret needle, and you know,
yeah.
But
that has to do with, you know, everybody does different things, and not everybody's aware of how those roles connect to each other, and how do we interact with each other, and how do we help the whole person, you know?
Right. So a lot of the agencies, if they're lucky enough, they'll staff a psychiatrist, or multiple psychiatrists if they're super lucky. And they can be kind of a part of the, you know, the treatment team. So it's kind of from a team perspective, and meet various needs such as, you know, like obviously medication, and, you know, so it might be assigned a case manager to kind of make sure you're on your feet. You kind of, you're able to kind of eat and live and just kind of survive. Maybe you need housing, And so therapy, if there's, you know, as we do an assessment with or an intake when people come in, we kind of assess whether they need therapy, you know, whether it would be beneficial. And so there's a lot of different ways that needs are being met kind of as they come into the system, into the program. And that's that holistic sort of treatment model that is going to really, make a difference at the end of it. And so we talk about like, okay, what are the outcomes? What are, what is everything going to look like at the end? What do you, and, that's part of, you know, the assessment too, is we ask them like, what do you see a successful treatment looking like? What is your sort of, your vision for when you're discharging from our services? What does that look like? And, right. So combining that.
So what are we helping you heal too? Right. You know, I mean, that's the big piece of it. It's like, okay, so you have a picture of where you want to go because that's why you're in our services, right?
Right.
That's why you're coming to us to get help, because you have this picture of what you want to do. Sometimes when people very first come into our services, they are so lost that they don't even know what they want. So, right. You know, that beginning phase is usually really, their family members might be able to tell you more than they can tell you as far as what they want out of the program. Because they just got to a place and they can't, some people, it's hard for them to even think straight, but they just don't know, you know?
Right. There's this kind of fear of like sending someone off into a system or something and wanting to support them, but, that can be overwhelming and really just, draining
and scary
and frightening.
Yeah. Very frightening. And they know that they have to do something different at that point, and some people are ready for it, and some people are kind of pushed into it a little. So it kind of depends on what brings them in to begin with.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's just definitely. This whole big, unknown.
Well, and it takes, if there's a support system in place, it takes the buy-in from that support system to not only encourage them to participate in the program, but, also help with follow-through and provide some, support, because ultimately the goal, I know this might be emphasized sometimes by politicians that want to cut funding, but our ultimate goal is not to create this sort of sense of dependence on, receiving these services on, we don't want people to be stuck in the system forever. And that may not have always been the case in the field, but it's kind of changed to that point to where we, are actively working towards seeing substantial goals set and met and making sure that they're measurable and all that. What are the, just to maybe clear this up, because people might be wondering kind of what in community and mental health are the variety of types of disorders you'll see or commonly see, maybe some of the problems that people are having.
Well, I mean, the big ones are really depression, anxiety. Mm-hmm. Those are some of the biggest ones. PTSD, people experiencing traumas and not being able, not dealing with them or not being able to deal with them at the time when things had happened. And next thing you know, they're going along their life and thinking things are fine. And all of a sudden things aren't anymore.
Right.
And sometimes people just need to step back. Our minds and our bodies kind of tell us, it's like, step back a minute, hold up. Mm-hmm. You need to deal with this before you keep moving forward. Because until you do, that whole next step sometimes isn't always going to work well,
Yeah.
You have, schizophrenia, personality disorders. There's lots of different types of things that we work together on. And these diagnoses are just, they're symptoms of things people are dealing with. My biggest struggle is giving someone a diagnosis, although I know, understand the necessity of it. Some people will feel relief when they finally have a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. Other people feel like they're being labeled.
Mm-hmm.
So diagnosis is a challenging topic in itself.
Right. And just to explain kind of the necessity of a diagnosis, that may not be something that's clear to people. Why is diagnosing even important in the system?
Okay, there's two primary reasons. One reason is because an insurance isn't going to pay for something because it's just some random issue, right? They want to have a name to it. So that's one reason. The other reason is in order for us to serve people with the best evidence-based practice, we have to have a general idea of what their symptoms are and have an understanding of what they are so that way we can help treat them with the best evidence-based practice for the symptoms that we're seeing in the consumer or the person is experiencing.
Right.
So those are the two primary reasons and focuses behind them.
Yeah, and I mean, the big answer is, of course, insurance payment. How do we pay for this?
Yeah.
And
exactly.
That's going to be a whole kind of probably separate episode I do, and maybe even you can't even break that down into one, I think. But that's something I do want to kind of clear up.
That's true.
Too, is just kind of like, what, you know, where does this money come from? How's your community affected by how mental health is funded? When we say, oh, we got to have better mental health,
what does that mean exactly?
How do we get there?
Exactly.
Get there with money
exactly.
is a big part of it.
Yeah. Money and awareness.
Right. Money and awareness. I mean,
awareness.
Yeah. Because it's, you know, we, as much as fun as it is, I know you like to work for free.
But me
on the other hand, I like to get paid. It's the reality, and it's the kind of cruel reality is the limited finances that are available and trying to meet the needs of everybody that has needs that presents to you. And it's a really difficult thing to balance. It's hard enough in general medical practice, you know, in a hospital setting, let alone mental health facilities that have far less funding. And then you get out to, you know, like out in St. Joseph, Missouri, that would be considered more of a rural region. Mental health funding is even more scarce. A big part of that is kind of the politics and just maybe the dispersed population. And, there's all kinds of challenges that come with that. All kinds of challenges.
Absolutely.
So it's pretty complicated. I might just do, you know, I'm my mind's going kind of a million places as we're talking about this. I'm thinking, okay, yeah, I could just set this topic aside for another day, and so. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm figuring it out, Jody.
Yeah, that's all right. So, you know, that's probably the biggest challenge I think for a lot of people is the diagnosing piece. Why do we got to be diagnosed? Why does society view people that are diagnosed differently? But a lot of people don't understand what is the purpose behind diagnosing people.
Right. Yeah. It is kind of misunderstood. Variety of ways, and it can change. Yeah.
Exactly. So as people start healing, you know, it might go from one place, you know, it might go from major depression to, you know, a different type of depression or something like that, you know,
right.
And over time, because some of them are time connected, so then it's going to change again.
Yeah.
So
and there's different set of diagnoses for children and you know, oppositional defiant disorder. You kind of see ADHD kind of being more in that age group than you do in adults. So as you kind of go up through the timeline, there's other, diagnoses that become more prevalent. You know, a schizophrenia diagnosis kind of has its onset schizophrenia symptoms, I should say, have their onset typically either adolescence 18. Or early adulthood. And,
yeah, 18 to 24 usually.
Kind of that transition period as when it starts right. to first show, and which is can be shocking for a lot of families who, you know, thought that they had what they would, I guess, call a normal, you know, sort of situation.
Yeah, this person had a normal childhood. What's the deal?
Normal childhood, yeah. And now he's seeing visions, you know, seeing people, mm-hmm. hearing voices that are telling him to kill himself or to kill others, and, you know, or you know, all kinds of different levels of shock that can happen when mental health diagnoses kind of become prevalent, especially one as severe as schizophrenia.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, the positive thing is a lot of the time with, you know, with the right right support and the right kind of treatment, it can be pretty easily treated. You know, a variety of different severities, right? So there are some cases that, you know, even, you know, heavily medicated, kind of receiving basically all the types of treatments that it can, you're still going to have some severe symptoms. And but, you know, there are a lot of cases that you know get on the right psychotropic sort of you know, like stabilizer, and life becomes somewhat normal. We meet a lot of people in community mental health that have schizophrenia, and we'd never know, you know, unless we kind of reviewed the documentation absolutely. Beforehand.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and then mood disorders. I mean, you have people with mood disorders, and that's another thing in itself. It's like one minute everything's going along fine, next minute not so much, and
right.
people around them can be quite surprised.
Right. Yeah. What do you think the media gets wrong about mental health? It's kind of a loaded question.
The media. Yeah, that is kind of a loaded question. We talk about this a lot in social work in our ethics classes and things. The media itself, you know, first of all, they like to discuss, you know, in movies we see a lot of the extreme stuff, but not the stuff that's so extreme that they can't put it in film. Mm-hmm. We see, you know, there are some pretty horrific things that people have experienced in their life that no one would dare watch in a movie. But yet at the same time, when they do put things on screen, it's usually in a horror flick or some kind of scary movie or, yeah. you know, a very traumatizing thing. It's one of those things that are like, oh yes, this happened, and then oh, life was beautiful after that. Well, most of the time, people that deal with mental health stuff, you know, mental health issues. I choose to call them issues because, you know, we all have issues.
Right.
And sometimes they come and go, you know.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I mean, yeah, a person can experience depression, but does that mean they're going to be depressed for the rest of their life? No, they can heal and grow and learn to manage a lot of that. They may have another episode in their lifetime, and they may not. It's more likely that they'll have another one, you know, if they have two. You know, periods of depression in their life.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and that's the thing a lot of people don't understand is, you know, it's not just because you get diagnosed with this when you're, you know, 21 doesn't mean you're going to have to experience those symptoms for the rest of your life, and you won't hold that diagnosis forever. Very rarely is that the case.
Right. Or it may be in a system somewhere in kind of, you know, someone's chart somewhere, but really in day-to-day life, it's there's nothing like kind of dictating how you're going to live your life or, you know, even how.
Right. And if you've learned skills to manage that stuff or to minimize the extremeness of whatever it was that was impacting you when you went to get help, there's no reason you can't continue to manage it on your own. But if you need help, you're aware of at what point. That's one of the things that I hope people learn is, okay, I am at a point where I cannot do this on my own. I need help. It's okay to ask for it. And when we treat people poorly that have mental health issues or were like, oh my God, you have depression. I can't hang out with you.
Right.
Oh my. Because you're a downer, right? You know, we talk about that Debbie Downer kind of thing. And it's like, well, okay, maybe today.
Right.
There are some people that are naturally that way more frequently. But at the same time, if we avoid them, they're definitely going to be that way more frequently.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
you know what I mean?
You're,
so
you're going to,
we can perpetuate.
Right. You're going to, yeah, by isolating someone, you know, if someone's
you're creating.
Staying away from me or treating me like, you know, I kind of want to keep my distance because you're going to just ruin my day.
You're going to break me down, right?
Yeah, I'm going to feel pretty, worthless. I'm going to kind of internalize some thought about myself like, oh, well, I must not be a very pleasant person to be around. That's pretty depressing. And, you know,
exactly, you know, and then it's, you know, our thoughts start feeding on that and it keeps perpetuating it over and over again.
Right. Yeah. So that's another challenge. So
yeah.
full of challenges,
stigma.
Yeah. A myriad of challenges in community mental health. So why the word community? What's the difference in adding the word community? It may be an obvious question to ask, but, I'm going to ask it.
Oh, what is the difference between community mental health and regular mental health?
Yeah, yeah. Like, so some people might say, okay, a mental health therapist or something. I have my therapist's office or I go to my doctor's office, but a community mental health center. Ooh, that sounds.
it sounds so screwy and like they can do everything, right?
Sounds traumatizing.
Well. Now, and this is the thing that I've come to understand. Some people might not see quite the same way, but my understanding of it is the community mental health center, typically where like state governments will, if they're going to fund a mental health agenda, if you will, throughout the state, they're going to do it through the community mental health facilities. Typically, that is, they are serving a population of people that are in poverty because they're the ones that have the most challenges of getting their community, their mental health needs met. Mm-hmm. And then you'll have the next, and that piece is where things are going to be a lot more intense. To try and get people from that more intense community stage to the next level where they'll go to a mental health facility. But more often than not, they'll start being more private insurance at that next stage.
Right.
And then you'll have like a private practice. So then you definitely would have people that are either going to pay out of pocket because they're more on the wealthy side of things, or they do have the insurance that is going to pay for the private practice.
Right. And that really is the big separator kind of when you compare is basically wealth, you know, do you come from poverty? Mm-hmm. If you come from poverty, you're not going to be able to, you know, afford to pay $100 a week for, you know, to sit down across from a therapist
I love that you said $100 a week, because more often than not, if you're paying out of pocket, it's going to be a little bit higher than that.
Yeah, yeah, I'm taking the very, very
you're
low
being so
end.
Kind.
I'm taking the very low end of like cash only, sort of very nice. Like, oh, mm-hmm. I'm going to try to do a community service therapist. Yeah. A lot of times, yeah, that price tag for an hour session can be.
Right.
Know,
and what Medicare pays and what it, you know, private insurance will pay is going to be two different things.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And what they allow are going to be different. But let's also have that conversation because we talk about poverty. And I just, because it was brought up in that context, I want people to be aware that poverty isn't people that have been poor their whole life. Mm-hmm. Poverty can be people that have become poor because of a medical issue that happened. You know, they'll be working 40 hours a week and the only thing they can now afford is because they lost their job or something and they don't have private insurance. Mm-hmm. They now, what are their options?
Right.
you know, and they get depressed because they can no longer do what they've done for the last, you know, 15 years because something happened. It could be a car accident, some medical issue.
Right. You develop acute mental health symptoms. So short-term intense mental health symptoms like, you know, PTSD or major depression or
Exactly. Like I said, there's so many ranging things for it, but I just like to make sure that is a clear dialogue because poverty, a lot of people, when they hear the term poverty, they think it's like a forever thing.
Right, right. And,
you know, they were poor children and they were, you know, they just didn't work. And it's like, no, that's not usually the case.
Well, because then we're getting into assumptions that are made when we use certain terms and we're getting, attitudes and kind of perpetuated stereotypes that we run into about the poor, about even when we talked about, okay, what does community mean? I understood that when that was happening, when I threw that question out there, that there is a mentality of when we say even just like kind of on a community or public or, you know, kind of get to more of kind of a racially charged issue of like the word urban or something like that, you know, it conjures up biases in people's minds. And so when we start to kind of get into the weeds of that, then we have a whole bunch of perceptions, of attitudes, of, you know, preconceived notions that maybe weren't intentionally developed, but, you know, just kind of we were raised in an environment where that was kind of what we thought about, you know, people who are in poverty are just always in poverty and they're doing it because they just won't work. And if you just give them money, then they'll buy a Mercedes or, you know, like, why aren't they just, you know, bootstraps philosophy, basically? Why isn't, you know?
Exactly. And that's why I just wanted to make sure, you know, when we had that conversation, I was.
No, and I appreciate you making sure that we're addressing that, because that's a really important point. And that's honestly something I want to be focusing on. I'm kind of trying to be direct about, you know, where I'm coming from as far as my perspective as to, you know, how systems are in place. I'm trying to look at it from a theoretical perspective, be pretty technical, but kind of there's analysis that comes with. You have to kind of make a judgment call when you're talking about issues too, and you know, objectivity does not necessarily have to mean neutrality. And I don't really value neutrality in the same sense as I do objectivity. So
right.
It's kind of I feel like that's kind of mistaken for one another, especially in a kind of news media setting.
Right.
But,
it's just something I've been seeing a lot lately, and it's been starting to concern me more and more. Because when we talk about poverty, it's really viewed in a very stereotypical fashion. And that's not the reality of it.
Well, I will add to this that recently there was the Trump administration kind of did the thing with Medicaid where they added kind of this clause or this kind of ability for individual states to add work requirements to Medicaid. And so it's, you know, kind of on the surface, it sounds like, you know, if you're going to get something, you should be working. So kind of from the outset, you kind of, maybe you have that thought like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. You know, you should work if my tax dollars and blah, 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 you know? But I mean, to put performance, you know, requirements on these services. I mean, first of all, like in my experience, and, you know, I might kind of ask for your perspective, but, a lot of the people that we've worked with on Medicaid are working not just one job, but maybe two or three jobs.
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah, they're working part-time jobs at different places, and you know, because after all, the agencies can't afford to have people on full time. And if they can't afford to have them on full time, you know, they're not paying enough and they still qualify for certain insurance. I mean, it's so complex. The insurance system, you know, there's so many aspects of it. Like you said, you're going to cover some more of that another time, which I'm thankful for.
Right. I might.
But it's really complex.
Yeah, it is. It is. And it's complex, but it's, you know, kind of might be easy to sort of ignore if you're coming from kind of the privileged enough perspective to be able to ignore it. Like I have pretty good work,
right.
You know, benefits. And so I can just say, you know, it doesn't affect me. Yeah, whatever. You know, we can affect those public programs
exactly.
that I'm not on, but our perceptions about things kind of color, you know, how we view it. And if we kind of ignore some of these changes, then they're pretty substantial changes that affect our community, that affect poverty, that affect, you know, the outcome of the community that's around us, crime, et cetera. Like everything is kind of affected by how we are willing to treat people and the perceptions that we take. And
exactly,
a lot of this is interconnected, and you're right.
we'll be
doing a Medicaid episode probably, Medicaid and mental health.
Yeah,
but
Medicaid and Medicare, and right. how they're different and
right.
cover different things, and
right.
You know, it takes somebody with a degree to help many people with going through with it. Yeah, you know, and the other aspect is, you know, with all that complexity of doing all those documents, you know, it wasn't that long ago people didn't need more than eighth grade education.
Right.
So
right.
you have people's reading abilities, you know, at very different levels. And that's, you know, that's our aging population.
Oh, absolutely. You get, you know, kind of the basic. You kind of generalize, maybe you project and assume and say that, okay, well, you can probably read, right? If you're an adult, well, maybe not
always the case,
maybe not at a functional level. Maybe not always the case. Maybe not at all. Or, you know, maybe some of the
right.
skills that you have, you assume are just kind of innate skills for, you know, going to a job interview, but, you know,
right. Well, and there's a lot of documents. I mean, when we get certain documents from the state, sometimes you got to ask somebody that's familiar with that their style of writing. I can read just fine, and I can comprehend just fine. But when you get certain documents, it's like, wait a minute, this doesn't read quite right. Who do I go to that's experienced with these particular documents?
Right.
You know what I mean? A lot of the government documents read very interestingly. And it depends on which branch you're getting it from. Let me just say.
Yeah, it really does. It really does.
Yeah, you know I'm right.
Yeah, no, we should just say, just keep saying the word complexity over and over again.
Let it go at that.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
Right.
But yeah.
Yeah, it's... There's just a lot going on in it, and it's understandable that there would be these misconceptions about community mental health centers, because honestly they're overwhelming, they're complicated. Like as you step when you first get a job at a community mental health center, you know, I can attest, you step into there, even if you've worked in a mental health center before, and you go into a new one. And you're just completely overwhelmed. There's just, you know, just something different.
So happening. Much information.
There's all these different processes that were developed to try to do things right. There were, you know, kind of all these different types of terminologies that you have to learn. You know, electronic medical record systems you have to learn. You know, hierarchies and processes you know, the, you know, and then you get to the different function of the population. Like I stepped into a substance use, dual diagnosis, facility, and I'd never worked with people, you know, who were predominantly using drugs and having mental health issues before. So I had to, you know, not on an everyday basis. And so that was a pretty huge adjustment just with the population, let alone with all of the different things being different and all the different services that we offer, you know, and all different funding sources in Kansas City, Missouri, and Jackson County. You know, we have like an anti-crime initiative that funds substance abuse counseling and stuff like that. Right. So
let me just be clear when I say you're brave, that being able to step out of a role that you know and you got kind of comfortable with. Into a new role. I mean, that takes a lot of courage and a lot of bravery.
Well, I did kind of throw that lure out so I could get some compliments and bring him in. So I appreciate you going along with that.
But you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's not easy trying something new and, you know, stepping outside a world that you got kind of comfortable with because, I mean, let's face it, after you've been in a place for a little while, you get a little comfortable with the people you're around and doing what you're doing. But then stepping out of that and saying, no, I want to try something different. I want to do this. You know what I mean? That takes a lot of courage and a lot of bravery, just like asking for the help. It takes just as much bravery to do that.
Well, and this is kind of another reason why, you know, this conversation's happening, why I want this conversation to happen and why I want it to be somewhat useful and helpful for people is to kind of pull back the veil, pull back the curtain of the intimidating force that is mental health. And 'cause there's so many, you know, there's so much going on and there's so much that it means for the community, even if a lot of people aren't aware that like an agency exists, the impact that that these agencies and that this whole system has on, you know, the well-being of the people in the community that you're in might be something that influences your life, even if you don't know about it.
Oh, absolutely. Most people don't just go, oh yeah, I go here. Some do, but
some
you're not going to run into
some
it very
really
often.
Do, but yeah, not often.
Some are thrilled, but
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
others
sing praises.
They want to keep it hush hush.
Yeah. Hey, right. Mm-hmm. And you know, as someone who has a loved one who's, experiencing, significant mental health symptoms, someone who, is experiencing them themselves, even just as kind of a neutral party. You know, you're not completely neutral, especially if you vote, especially if you are active kind of in your community, or especially if you, you know, have conversations about other topics where mental health is tied in and you're kind of, you know, kind of building a dialogue in that community about, how mental health is going to be looked at, kind of for all those different variables and reasons. I kind of want to shed some light on that. So I appreciate you, coming on tonight, to do that. I know, it seemed like I wasn't going to call, but I came through eventually.
You did come through. Well, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, my son goes to bed usually around the 8 o'clock hour, so I probably should have mentioned that, but I just, you know, went for the surprise element.
Definitely.
I'm, you know, I'll keep you. You'll be one of the contributors. I feel like, to the show, I feel like, there's a lot of, you know, cause kind of, as we work together, we, kind of got off on tangents and had some conversations that I felt, yeah, maybe they'd be useful if more people heard them. So,
right.
So that's kind of,
oh yeah. And there's lots of topics out there that, you know, I like to talk about them.
Yeah, no, I know you do. That's why I knew you were a viable guest to have on. And yeah, absolutely. Kind of a feature that I like to build into the end of these podcasts, as the conversation kind of draws to a close, is instituting mandatory coping skills. So that's a world where I force everyone, to use coping skills and improve their mental health. It might seem kind of, aggressive, but I feel like, it'll get better outcomes. You know, the stuff we talk about. is pretty anxiety provoking, pretty stressful.
It is.
Yeah.
You know, and the funny thing is people use coping skills all the time, every day. Mm-hmm. They just don't always realize that's what they're doing.
Right.
And they don't always, you know, because in our professional field, we have a special name for them, you know, and a lot of people will say, oh, that's just how I deal, you know.
Right.
So we definitely
can describe that kind of gargantuan sort of or cheesy or whatever adjective you want to add to it, some kind of term that we say coping skills, you know, it might kind of build some sort of monolithic meaning, but it really just is ways that you get by,
yep.
Things that you do.
Yeah. Things that I do. Well, I learned one a couple years ago, when I worked at a children's residential facility, and I still use it pretty regularly. When I find that I start getting stressed, I kind of go back to a moment. I create these moments throughout time that I kind of like to hold on to, and they're moments that you just felt, you know, where life almost stood still, but it was a very calming and relaxing thing. And so what I'll do a lot of times is I'll visualize myself in that moment again. One that I love to reclaim more often than not is seeing a bird flying. Hmm. You know, where was I sitting when I was watching this bird fly? I mean, it was so freeing watching this bird fly. You know, and I just got to let go of everything that I was holding on to at that moment. Mm-hmm. You know, and then just breathing. And if the air was blowing on me at that time, was it summer, spring, winter? You know, what season was it? And just kind of picture myself in that moment and give myself a few minutes of just breathing while holding on to that experience.
Okay. Yeah, so kind of a visualization.
You can visualize it. Yeah, it's a visualization, you know, with the breathing added to it. So a lot of times I find that more helpful than a lot of other things. Nature for me is a kind of a big deal.
Oh, yeah, totally. And so, Jody, would you like to guide us in the audience in one of these exercises?
Okay, so the one that I like to use is I will have been sitting in the car, the radio was off, windows were open, so I'm breathing. I could feel the breeze, and I look through the windshield, and I see a bird soaring through the sky, but with their wings expanded wide open. They weren't flapping, they were just gliding ever so gently through the sky. It's like they caught part of that wind that I could feel on my body, and I could feel it on my face. And the bird was just flying through the sky just calmly. And I could just breathe in and watch it glide. And do that for just, you know, about the count of 10, count of 15. Kind of depends on what you need at the moment. And it's just very calming for me. Still there.
Yep. I appreciate you sharing that.
Okay.
Yeah, there's no sort of, there's that kind of moment where we're like, okay, how long are we going to actually, you know, sit in this?
Right. Right. Well, and that's the thing. I mean, you can let your bird fly as, you know, or soar as far or as long as you need it to, you know?
I do enjoy the expression, let your bird fly. It has multiple meanings.
But you know what I'm saying? You know, it's like soar, you know, just soar. it can be, you know, where you're reaching for. It can be, you know, bringing the calm to you.
Yes.
Or it can be taking your troubles away. Whatever you need it for, it's going to be there for you. I like the visualization ones.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm a picture person member.
Yeah, you are. And that's more powerful when you can sort of, when you do have that sort of ability to vividly imagine things. And I think we all, to a certain level, have an ability to do some imagery, and then for other people, some other things work best. But awesome. Thank you so much for sharing that, for being a part of this authoritarian policy of mandatory coping skills. And
not a problem.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you coming on and being a guest for Off Baseline.
Yeah, not a problem, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'll have you back on. We'll talk some more about mental health.
All right, will do.
And we're going underground.